Does anyone, does the Commonwealth wish to, Ms. Johnson, do you wish to reserve any rebuttal time?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes rebuttal.
Very good. Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you very much. May it please the Court, I'm Victoria Johnson on behalf of the Commonwealth this morning. I'd like to begin with the procedural issues, if I may. I think that, first of all, my first point is that the petition for appeal in this case is timely filed, kind of no matter how we look at it, if we just look at the plain statutory language or if we look at...
Judge Petty. I was going to say it's Judge Petty, but I assume you all can... let's back up just a moment to the transcript itself, because that seems to be something that there's no question was filed beyond the deadline provided. And
it
appears, first of all, we have to address the question of whether the transcript is necessary to decide this issue. I was looking at your site to... Elliott versus Commonwealth that dealt with the issue of whether this is a pre-trial or post-trial motion or appeal. And that case says that the defendant is required to ask the court to adopt the rulings on either on its own motion or a motion of one of the parties. So the court has to effectively adopt the rulings or there has to be another hearing.
That's correct.
How do we know what the court did in this case? Did it simply adopt the rulings, or were there additional facts presented or stipulated to? Without the transcript, how do we know what it based this ruling on?
Your Honor, I think in this case that this is kind of a unique case, and I submit that we can look at the order here in this case, and as the court knows, trial courts speak through their orders and all that. Here, the order that's appealed from is at Appendix 343, and it says, this case came before this court today for argument on the Commonwealth's motion to introduce evidence and the defendant's motion to enforce the ruling from trial. And we can look at those pleadings because those are in the record. The court, after hearing argument, denied the Commonwealth's motion to introduce evidence based on constitutional grounds. The court, after hearing argument, granted the defendant's motion to enforce the ruling from trial court based on constitutional grounds. Given the posture of this case, that this controversy throughout this entire case has been this Fifth Amendment issue, you know, whether there was an invocation, whether there was a waiver, and we have, you know, the original suppression hearing, the mid-trial motion to suppress, followed by the mistrial, and then this procedure before, you know, after the Commonwealth elected to retry. I submit that looking at the entirety of the record, it's kind of impossible to come to a different conclusion.
Well, let's assume you're correct, and I think this may be the Hobson's choice that the Commonwealth is faced with. If that is, in fact, what the court did, is simply, in the words of Elliott, adopt the ruling. The ruling itself was made after the jury was impaneled. If the court is simply adopting that ruling, it is adopting a post-trial order, a ruling. Doesn't that preclude the Commonwealth from appealing?
I disagree with you there, Judge Petty, because they are adopting a mid-trial ruling, but they are adopting it in a pre-trial proceeding. When a trial ends in a mistrial, it isn't a nullity. I agree with that. It's not like a null pros or, you know, a de novo appeal from a general district court proceeding. It's not like that. It is, but it's a trial that's ended on a mistrial. There's a disposition there, and it's a, you know, the old cases call it an aborted trial. And in order for anything else to happen, the Commonwealth has to do something. The Commonwealth has to elect to retry. And the Commonwealth would, you know, we have to again decide, are we going to take a jury? Are we going to take a bench trial? You know, we have to decide that. And so the first jury was discharged. That jury's gone. Another jury's going to have to be sworn. And while the court adopted that previous ruling, it did so in a pretrial posture.
I think my answer says
neither fish nor fowl, but...
Well, we've said on a number of occasions, for instance, in the context of speedy trial,
right,
that the trial commences when the first trial begins,
mm-hmm.
Whether bench trial or jury trial, and that ends the calculations for speedy trial purposes. So
right.
Why don't we adopt that same language here and say, well, the trial commenced, and thus any subsequent rulings that or subsequent affirmation of pretrial rulings are post-trial?
Because I think we're looking at two competing rights, Judge Petty. In the speedy trial context, we're looking at, you know, whether, say it's, you know, a plain old, just Virginia statutory speedy trial, because that's easy, you know, whether the trial commenced within 5 months. So if the trial commenced within 5 months, then that right's been vindicated, even if the trial ended in a mistrial. So there's no reason to restart that speedy trial clock. I think that's what Fisher and the other cases stand for, is that proposition. It's kind of a carve-out for the right there. But here, we're not really looking at where the trial commenced. We're kind of looking at where the trial ended. Here, the trial ended in a mistrial. And I think looking at the Upchurch case, I think Upchurch is actually kind of helpful. Because Upchurch, which I believe is cited by both parties, I know I cited it, Upchurch, which talks about... You know, the requirement that motions to suppress be made pre-trial in order, you know, for a lot of policy reasons, but notably so the Commonwealth isn't deprived of its statutory right to appeal. You know, we talk a lot about the Commonwealth having a narrow statutory right and that right being in derogation of the Constitution and all that. But there is still a statutory right to a Commonwealth appeal. Here, because of the kind of mid-trial nature of the rehearing in the trial court, that the Commonwealth found itself kind of out of luck. But after the mistrial was granted, you know, the Commonwealth took steps to try to exercise its right towards a pretrial appeal.
Suppose we disagree with you that the transcript is not, we conclude that it is necessary for the resolution of the appeal.
Mm-hmm.
What's your position on whether there was a clerical error that can be, so that the transcript can be filed pursuant to the Supreme Court's holding in Ballew?
In Ballew, Your Honor, I think that Ballew is certainly a case that can guide the court in this situation. In Ballew, the Supreme Court of Virginia essentially excused a defense attorney who had ordered transcripts.
But as far as this particular case, mm-hmm. is there evidence of a clerical error? And if so, where do we find it?
I attached the petition, the Commonwealth's response to the motion to dismiss as an addendum to my brief, and there are emails attached to that.
Where does that show that the clerk made an error as opposed to the Commonwealth's attorney just neglecting to follow up to make sure the transcript was filed?
Well, Judge, I think that's the question, and that is the exact same argument that this office made in Ballew. In Ballew, we argued that the attorney just did not follow up with the court reporter to make sure that the proper transcripts had been filed,
but
and Ballew, the Court of Virginia rejected that argument.
In Ballew, the record affirmatively showed that the clerk erroneously entered into the computer system the fact that no hearing was held on a day on which a hearing was in fact held. So there was clear evidence, and the trial court found that to be the case of a clerical mistake. And I'm trying to see here, where is there anything to indicate the clerk neglected or did not do something he or she was required to do?
Judge Petty, in candor with the court, I'm unable to point to a specific error.
All right, well, let me move you on to one other.
Sorry, Judge Petty.
Troubles me on this case.
Yeah.
It's clear that, at least it's clear to me, that the notice of filing of transcripts, the notice of filing of transcripts was filed, I think, 4 days after the transcripts were actually filed. And then, of course, that triggers the time period for the petition of appeal. What
That's
troubles
correct.
Me is that if we read the rule literally, saying
mm-hmm.
that the petition for appeal needs to be filed within a certain number of days after the notice of filing of transcript, it basically allows the Commonwealth to delay filing of the transcript to the last second, but past the last second, and then claim extra time for filing the petition. Why shouldn't we read that requirement that the notice of filing a transcript should be filed within 3 days of the filing of the transcript or on the last day on which the transcript could have been filed?
On the last
you know
day of the transcript could have been filed?
If the transcript has to be filed by, say, January 15th, that's
mm-hmm.
the last day on which the transcript can be filed within the deadline. Why shouldn't we read the rule to require that the notice of filing then be filed by January 18th?
I think I understand the court's question, and I'm going to kind of, if I may, kind of rephrase it to make sure I understand it, because I don't want to say something wrong. Is the court asking if the 25-day requirement for filing a transcript should be read that the Commonwealth has to file the notice for filing transcripts within 3 days of when the transcript should have been filed, been filed?
In this case,
extending the Spinola holding
in this
to the
case,
filing transcript?
In this case, the petition for appeal was
mm-hmm.
not filed within the required period of time from the date the notice of filing of transcripts should have been filed if the transcripts were filed timely.
If the transcripts were filed timely.
Correct.
That's what I thought you were asking. Okay. I just wanted to make sure that I was understanding the question. Well, Judge, that's why I included my argument about Spinola, because I kind of saw this coming. I think that the statute says what it says. The plain language of the statute says what it says. And there is always going to be some inadvertence and mistake when parties are perfecting appeals. I think that is something that we always see all of the time. I think that adding in language to the statute that changes the requirement from when something was filed to when it should have been filed adds language to the statute. And I submit that adding language to a statute goes beyond mere strict construction and could lead to results where, as here, an entire appeal could be lost for failure to timely file what may be an unnecessary transcript, a transcript that's unnecessary to the resolution of the appeal. And I submit to the court that that is a little bit of an absurd result, and that it is inconsistent with cases decided under the regular appellate rules, particularly Rule 5A8. It elevates the failure of timely filing transcripts to a jurisdictional default, or a jurisdictional fault.
Well, no, I'm talking about, what we're talking about is the timely filing of the petition for appeal, which is jurisdictional.
Right. But since everything kind of runs from the filing of the transcript and then the notice of filing transcript under the Commonwealth Appeal Rules, by putting in the should have filed language, I think it has a domino effect that the General Assembly did not necessarily intend.
But my problem is that the statute,
right,
the whole statutory scheme is designed to expedite the pretrial appeal process.
And I understand that, Judge.
And with Ballou now out there, Ballou can effectively extend or allow for perhaps a nunk-pro-tunk, if you will, late filing of transcripts, and thus late filing of notice of filing of transcripts. And it seems to me that if we don't construe this strictly, what we're doing is extending the period of time for filing the petition for appeal by monkeying around with the time the notice of filing of transcripts is due.
Well, Your Honor, I do note that, you know, as to the court's concern for the expeditious filing, that a 45-day extension for time for good cause shown is available under 19.2405 for the filing of transcripts. So that actually allows for a total of 70 days for filing of transcripts. I believe the transcripts here were filed about 40 days after the entry of the order. So as far as the concern about the expeditious filing, this was within a period of time within the kind of the intent of the statute. So this isn't a situation where the Commonwealth was dragging its feet for months and months. I think that if a situation like that comes up, the court can deal with that on a case-by-case basis.
Ms. Johnson, this is Judge Chafin. And
yes, Judge Chafin.
Used all of your time and a bit more.
Certainly.
You were answering questions put to you by the court. So I will give you a minute or so to wrap up in reference to this, and I will extend you a couple of minutes on rebuttal. I'll do the same as far as for Ms. Whitley and give her a little extra time as well.
Thank you very much. I believe that the real important, I think all the issues in this case are important. I think for the Commonwealth, getting past the procedural issues here are vital. It's to the extent the court reaches the merits, I rest on my brief. If the court has any questions about the merits, I will certainly be happy to answer them at this time. I think that my merits argument is pretty straightforward. If the court has questions, as I said, I'd be happy to answer them. If not, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the panel members?
None from me.
No, and I apologize for eating up all your time, Ms.
Oh, no, Your Honor. And just briefly, I know the court has noted that there have been several cases lately, Commonwealth appeals lately, that have been procedurally defaulted. And I know that it's the court's policy not to publish Commonwealth appeals opinions, but I mean, as a practitioner, I think that it might be, you know, win or lose for the Commonwealth in this case. I think that it might be time for a bit of a refresher course, perhaps, for practitioners in this era, in this area. And with that, I'll preserve my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm just as an aside, I'm aware that this particular jurisdiction has a very competent former clerk of the Court of Appeals as an assistant
Commonwealth
attorney.
Who's recently gone over.
Perhaps that clerk could provide some training.
Yes, I noticed that addition recently. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Ms. Whitley.
Yes. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lauren Whitley with the Fairfax Public Defender's Office on behalf of Mr. Linares Caballero. And the failure to timely file the October 23rd transcript is fatal to the Commonwealth's case in this appeal. Without this transcript, this court has no jurisdiction to hear the Commonwealth's appeal. And also without this transcript, this court has an incomplete record and cannot reach the merits of the Commonwealth's untimely
file. Why do you say that, Ms. Whitley? Because the order clearly indicates that no evidence was taken at this hearing. It simply affirms the prior ruling of the court, which is adequately documented both in the pretrial motion and the evidence presented at trial. And it mentions that it is based on constitutional grounds, not evidentiary. So why do we need to look at what is in that, what would possibly be in that transcript that is required for us to decide the case?
Well, Your Honor, I think respectfully I disagree as far as, I guess there was no evidence presented, but there was argument, and the order does speak to the fact that argument was made on the Commonwealth's motion. In the motion itself, the Commonwealth, even though the motion speaks specifically to Fifth Amendment issues that had been previously discussed, the motion does say that they may rest on any further argument presented before the court at a hearing. And the difficulty for the Commonwealth is there are constitutional motions and issues that are not appealable. For example, a challenge to the 14th Amendment, a violation of voluntariness of a confession. What we have in the order is not a clear grant of the Commonwealth's motion to introduce evidence based solely on Fifth Amendment grounds. We have it based on constitutional grounds.
But the court's ruling was the ruling from the trial. That's what the order says, enforce the ruling from the trial. So we can look back to the trial transcript and determine what that ruling was based on.
I think that would be an unreasonable inference as far as making clear what the statutory grounds for a Commonwealth appeal are and the Commonwealth asserting those grounds in order to appeal a case. And I would point this court to, it's not a Commonwealth appeal, but the case in Fuller against Commonwealth, which was an unpublished case, but this court refused to reach the merits of a motion to suppress assignment of error where the transcript had been untimely filed. It was a defendant's appeal, and the defendant attempted to point the court to the trial transcript, which had allegedly identical testimony, and this court refused to do that. This court specifically stated we were unable to ascertain the party's arguments, the facts and evidence presented, the basis of the judge's ruling, and whether the evidence presented supports the denial of the motion. We don't know what was said or argued at that motion, and that becomes a problem for the Commonwealth when they have a very narrow, limited right to appeal under the statute. And this court's case law is very clear that statute is held strictly against them because of the general prohibition on Commonwealth's appeals. So despite there being argument previously in the record about the Fifth Amendment and the motion from the Commonwealth, the court's order is not clear on what grounds, what constitutional grounds it ruled on. Or if there were additional grounds that it ruled on. And the additional grounds becomes a problem because if there is an independent basis to grant the motion, as I stated, under the 14th Amendment voluntariness or under some other argument that may have been presented by the defense trial counsel or denied against the Commonwealth, this court cannot hear the case. And in Morrissey against Commonwealth, an unpublished case from last year, this court stated because there were two grounds the dismissal of the indictment, one which fell within the Commonwealth's appellate statute and one that did not, the court had no jurisdiction. So that transcript is the transcript directly connected to the order, and I would argue without it, this court cannot infer what was said or what was argued, and the order does nothing to clarify that, despite the lengthy record that exists in this case. I think more problematic for the Commonwealth, of course, is that transcript as well is necessary to reach the assignments of error because, again, we don't have that argument and we don't have the discussion with the court, with the Commonwealth attorney, and with defense counsel. Even without evidence presented, We don't know what was asserted to the court and what the court was ruling on and brought to the court's attention. That has been held in the past against appellant defendants. I would point the court to Kelly against Commonwealth, where this court refused to hear an additional ground in a motion to suppress because even though it was raised by the defendant in the motion to suppress in writing, it was never argued to the trial court at the actual hearing. And this court said that that was not sufficient to preserve that issue for appeal. And we don't know the situation here without the October 23rd transcript with regards to the adequacy of the record to review the alleged assignments of error. So
is
I think both of those things. Yes,
is this order a new ruling or simply a refusal to revisit a prior ruling?
I think it is all connected. From my, I think the way that this record reads, it's all connected. So it is essentially an adoption of the prior ruling from the previous trial, essentially, is how it seems to be articulated by the trial court in the order. So it's because it's granting, the trial court was granting the defendant's motion to enforce prior rulings and denying the Commonwealth's motion to introduce evidence. And that seems to essentially be bootstrapping back to the trial court's reconsideration of the motion to suppress that was made mid-trial.
Do you agree that if this were, in fact, a second motion to suppress being filed, the defense had come in and said, okay, I'm filing a new motion to suppress, that under the ruling of the Supreme Court in Elliott would be pretrial and appealable?
I would state that I think we would be in a harder position to challenge the pretrial status, yes. I think that would have been the proper procedure if the Commonwealth was as intent as they articulated in their motion in being able to appeal that reconsideration of the motion to suppress. As an advocate, I would have argued that it was still mid-trial because I believe that the case law from this court is pretty clear that there's a continuation of a trial after a mistrial when we're talking about retrying the case. But I think procedurally that would have been the Commonwealth's strongest position to argue that it was a new ruling and they had the right under the statute to appeal that ruling. And I do think that is a flaw for them procedurally here when we're talking about their motion to introduce evidence. The defendant responded saying that they didn't have really standing to do that. That was something that happened during the trial, but also filed an Elliott-style motion to reinforce previous rulings of the court, and then the court ruled on those, stating they were ruled on unconstitutional grounds. I also agree that the part of the problem here for the Commonwealth is the discussion that was being had earlier is that without the proper filing of the transcripts, the notice of filing of transcripts was untimely filed, and that renders the petition untimely filed. And that also is a jurisdictional problem for the Commonwealth in this case. And the difficulty here is that if the transcripts had been timely filed, the notice of filing of transcripts would have been due, the transcripts would have been due December 8th, the notice due December 11th, and the petition for appeal due December 26, 2015. This pushed basically the timeline back by 2 weeks. And the statute does permit the Commonwealth, just as it does for a defendant appellant, to ask for an extension of time. Sometimes it was the holidays. The court reporters will take a little bit longer to get things filed. But no motion was filed requesting that extension of time. And that's a significant difference as well from this case in Ballou. In Ballou, there was a proactive attempt by the defense attorney to make that missing transcript a part of the record. And my recollection is the Supreme Court of Virginia found it very significant that that attempt was made before the petition for appeal had been filed and docketed with this court. That was not the case here. Here, the petition for appeal was filed. There was a motion to dismiss filed by Mr. Linares Caballero, and that's when the Commonwealth attempted to try to address their failure to timely file the transcript. And I think that is... I'm sorry.
Could you speak to your argument briefly on why the notice, why the defendant was prejudiced by the late filing of the notice of filing of transcripts?
Right. I think that there's two prongs to it. We were not able to lodge any objections. I will concede that there are no substantive objections that would have been filed. There are some typographical errors. The defense attorney, trial attorney's name is wrong. Some de minimis corrections such as that. I think the more prejudicial problem here is that because of the late notice of filing of transcripts, the defendant, Mr. Leonard Caballero's counsel, me, myself, was without access to the transcripts for about a week. It comes down to about a week. The emails that were attached to the Commonwealth's brief made clear that the Commonwealth was not notified until after the Christmas holiday about the filing of the transcripts. But that was still a week that Mr. Linares Caballero did not have access to them if they had been noted, the notice of filing transcripts had been appropriately filed. They were filed on December 23rd. We were not, the notice was essentially filed with the circuit court on December 30th. We did not receive that notice as I attached the envelope to show proof of mailing until January 6th, which was the same day that we received the petition for appeal. So there was, and when we're talking about a Commonwealth's appeal, there's a very quick turnaround. Access to the transcripts can be very significant and would have been significant in this case to make sure that Mr. Linares Caballero's brief in opposition was properly prepared and filed. So at a minimum, under 588, there was prejudice here as far as the untimely filed transcripts. I also think that the Commonwealth has difficulty in this case because the ruling and the procedural style of the case, the ruling of the trial court was not pretrial. It was after a mistrial. There is case law from this court speaking about speedy trial, as was mentioned earlier, that a mistrial and retrial after a mistrial is not a new proceeding. It's a continuation of the original trial. And because of that, that motion to introduce evidence and the motion to adopt rulings, previous rulings, essentially connected that trial court's order on November 13th to the ruling that was made after a jury had been impaneled and witnesses sworn. So under the statute as well, this court doesn't have jurisdiction because this notice of appeal and appeal are not pretrial in the sense of the statute. I also just wanted to briefly address the merits of the argument here. There are two issues with this interrogation as far as Mr. Linares Caballero's rights under the Fifth Amendment, Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment. One is that it is clear from this video in this interrogation that Mr. Linares Caballero did not understand his rights, and he did not knowingly and intelligently waive them and understand the consequences of waiving them. I'd highlight a couple of things. One is that he states, "I don't understand," by my count, approximately 19 times throughout this interrogation. 45 minutes of the 80-minute video are spent explaining to him his rights under Miranda. It is clear he has a very limited intellectual functioning. He states early on that he cannot read or write in his native language, which is Spanish. He cannot spell part of his own last name. He cannot remember the day or year of his birth, and he can't remember the street or apartment number where he lives. The factual finding of the trial court is clearly based in the record, both those representations by Mr. Linares Caballero, but also the interaction between the interpreter, Mr. Linares Caballero, and Detective Hengemuel make clear that he does not understand the rights that they do patiently try to explain to him for quite a period of time, or the consequences of waiving those rights. And what's significant here about the trial court's reconsideration of the motion to suppress is that the trial court also had the advantage of observing Mr. Linares Caballero as he did his not guilty plea colloquy. And when we're talking about deference to the fact finder, that observation of witness demeanors and interactions and things like that are very significant to that deference to the fact finder. And the trial court specifically said when he was reconsidering the motion to suppress that, "I apologize, Mr. Linares Caballero, but I perceived during the not guilty plea colloquy a limited intellectual functioning." And during the colloquy, that's clear when Mr. Linares Caballero is not able to answer some very simple questions about his understanding of a jury or a judge trial, that the jury would determine his punishment. At one point, the Mr. Linares Caballero's trial counsel has to interrupt and say, you know, you have to ask him things in very short sentences. And the trial court had the privilege of being able to observe all of that, along with the interrogation video, and making
was there some evidence that there was a dispute between the interpreters as to whether the questions were and the answers that he gave in the interrogation were correctly interpreted?
There were some at the July 17th hearing. However, I would argue that that hearing is not part of the record for this appeal. And I raised that in my brief in opposition because the trial judge was different who heard the trial versus who heard the motion to suppress. So the trial judge did not have the opportunity to hear that testimony at the July 17th motion to suppress hearing about the differentiations between the interpreter who was there that day during the interrogation and I believe an interpreter who was presented by Mr. Linares Caballero to explain some of the errors in the interpretation. So I think that there was some evidence at some point in the record over this whole case, but I do not think it is relevant to this assignment of error because it's not connected to this trial court's decision because he did not have the advantage of that. But I think just from viewing the video and seeing the interactions, it's clear that there is a lack of understanding. The interpreter does interpret third person, which is also very confusing, rather than first person. So she's constantly referring he would say him, things like that, which makes it even more difficult for Detective Hengimuel and Mr. Linares Caballero to have that understanding and conversation about some pretty complicated rights and a pretty important moment in the investigation for Detective Hengimuel. So I think certainly that has been established, and here there's a presumption against waiver in the case law, and at this stage also there is a deference to the fact finder because this is a specific finding of fact and that it is entitled to a presumption of correctness on appeal, and the record clearly supports the trial court's finding of fact. I would also state, and I'll rely primarily on the arguments in the brief, but even if this court finds that Mr. Linares Caballero made a knowing and intelligent waiver, he clearly and unequivocally asserted his right to remain silent. He says at least three times, and I want to quote the first time he says it, he says that's what he would do, again, the interpreter interpreting in third person, that what he would do is not answer any of the questions. And I don't see how you can get more clear about your right to remain silent. It's not equivocal. He's not saying maybe, I think. And Detective Hengimuel continues to have a conversation with him. And the trial court did find Detective Hengimuel's furtherance in saying, so you're saying you don't want to talk to me then, so let me make sure I understand that was, as well, part and parcel of the violation of his Fifth Amendment rights. It was the continuation of that conversation. And that's the violation that Miranda does contemplate when we're talking about a defendant in that situation understanding their rights. So even if the court, yes.
Excuse me, I have extended you for almost 3 minutes more to give you additional time. We're going to need to wrap it up. Do the members of the panel have any additional questions for counsel?
No.
I don't. Okay. Thank you very much.
Is there anything else you wish to state in your conclusion?
I'm sorry?
Is there anything else you'd like to state? Are you resting on your brief?
Oh, no. No, ma'am. I would rest on the brief, and I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson, you indicated at the conclusion of your argument that you were resting on your brief. Is there anything additional you'd like to say?
Your Honor, I think that I will rest on my brief for the merits, and I would ask the court to reverse the judgment, to find that the court has jurisdiction and to reverse the judgment.
Very good. Thank you. Let me compliment both you, Ms. Johnson, and you, Ms. Whitley. That was very interesting and thought-provoking argument, and we will now adjourn to our conference to discuss the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.